figuratively. There are these five ways of speech that others may use when they address you. Their speech may be timely or untimely, true or untrue, gentle or harsh, connected with good or with harm, spoken with a mind of loving kindness or with inner hate. Okay, so this is already quite a nice thing to reflect upon. This is a kind of a summary of right speech, right? There's different ways of talking about right speech, and this is one of these ways. And of course, the point of this particular sutta is other people speaking to you in ways that are not nice, not pleasant. And because of that, this sutta talks about how you should react to that, how you should deal with not having having words coming your way which are not very nice. But it's also useful for us to remember that this is also a way for us to reflect on our own speech, right? So this is the, so here we have these five ways to, as I can very briefly just explain what this is about. Timely and untimely speech is knowing the right time to talk. Sometimes it's just wrong, right? Somebody is already upset and you want to tell them off or something. No, this is not the right time. So this knowing, understanding the right time for things is actually very important. If the other person is in a good mood and they are ready maybe to hear something and you have to say to them and you think they will take it aboard in the right way, then you can say something to them. Also Dhamma, right? If you want to speak Dhamma to somebody, right? They have to be ready to hear the Dhamma. Sometimes if you speak Dhamma to somebody who is not ready, you're wasting your time. And you're kind of, it's like, you know, it's stupid to teach Dhamma to somebody who isn't ready. I remember once I was in Singapore a few years ago and I was giving a Vaisak talk in Singapore. And they had invited, the idea was to invite people from different religions, right, to come together so that the Buddhists were kind of shown to be inclusive, right, to have invited everybody. So I had to give this talk. And there was a large room, maybe 200 people or something. And there were a few Buddhists there, but there was lots of Christians and Muslims and Sikhs and all kind of things in this room. And I had to give a talk to them. And they were absolutely uninterested, right? They didn't care at all about the Dhamma. They had just been invited by the Buddhist community. They weren't interested in what I had to say. They were sitting there, kind of playing with their smartphone, looking down, you know, doing things. And nobody was really looking at me. Nobody had any interest at all there. And I felt, you know, should I be doing this? Is this really appropriate, you know, giving teaching to somebody who's absolutely uninterested in it? And it feels strange, it feels wrong to give a teaching to people like that, because you know that it isn't really going, it doesn't go in. It's like you have this beautiful teaching and nobody really cares about it. So this is one example also of timely teaching, teaching at the right time to people who are actually interested. And this is why it's nice to be invited, right? I was invited to come here. If you go somewhere because you are kind of pushing your agenda, then of course it is always going to be slightly uneasy. But if you are invited, then it's actually very natural to be teaching in a very natural way when it comes from invitations. So that is always a good thing. And this is kind of the traditional way of doing things in Buddhism. You only teach when you are invited to do so. Anyway, timely and untimely speech. So that is an important one to reflect on. True and untrue. Probably fairly obvious, but remember, sometimes people talk about the fourth precept about speaking the truth, musavada, what it means, right? And sometimes people become like lawyers, and they say, okay, what are the exact boundaries, you know? How can I get away with not saying exactly the truth, but not really lying either? What is kind of the gray middle way? Because sometimes we don't want to tell the truth, right? But remember that don't be too much like lawyers, right? It doesn't really, karma doesn't work according to lawyers' legal framework. It doesn't work like that. The idea, according to the fourth precept and false speech, is to be trustworthy, somebody who doesn't deceive people, right? Because you can easily deceive people without lying necessarily. You can say, oh, yeah, you know, you can kind of leave the talk aside or do something kind of, you know, bad. But the idea is to be trustworthy. People feel they can trust you. That is the purpose of this. So it's not a legal thing, it's actually about your entire attitude to speaking the truth. Of course, the answer to your question is when saying the truth is not directly, is not appropriate also. Sometimes somebody may be very vulnerable or whatever it is. In that case, you're coming from compassion, so it's okay not to be direct. But if you are kind of distorting the truth a little bit because you're coming from greed or anger or whatever, then of course it's problematic. So these are, so these are some of the ways when you consider the precepts, is that remember, it's not about legality, it's about a broader understanding of what is appropriate. So, gentle and hard speech, right? Gentle speech tends to go to people's heart, to feel at ease and relaxed in your presence if your speech is gentle. If people speak harshly, you can, it's uncomfortable usually. Connected with good or with harm. Does somebody have your good, your benefit at heart? Or are they trying to harm you? Right? I was telling the other day the story of Ajahn Chah, who tells all his disciples, "You're all dog shit." Right? How can you get away with that? And the reason you can get away with that is they know, everybody knows that he has their benefit at heart, even though he's using pretty rough language, right? So, people know that, because they trust him so much, he can get away with that. Most people can't get away with that, right? If they say that, they are in serious trouble afterwards. So you address people, you actually think about the other person's benefit when you speak with them. The last one is about spoken with a mind of loving kindness. You're coming from metta, you're coming from you're kind to the person rather than actually being angry or hateful towards them. So very interesting little thing about speech there. It's really a summary of right speech in many ways. Okay, so the next sentence is pretty much repeated. With others address you, their speech may have all these qualities. Herein, because you should train thus, our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no bad words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare, with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading that person with a mind imbued with loving kindness. And starting with him, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with metta, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train, Bhikkhu. Right? So it doesn't matter what other people say. If people say bad things to you, you don't just affect your mind. If people flatter you and say nice things to you, that too doesn't affect your mind. You just allow those things to be. You know, this is just the nature of the world. But sometimes you get to hear bad things. Otherwise, other times you get to hear good things. This is just the way things are. And because of that, you don't respond in return, with harsh words of your own, but you just allow it to be. And instead, you have compassion for them. You understand if somebody says bad things to you, they are the first person to actually receive the bad consequences of that. And you have compassion for them. And you don't make trouble for yourself by becoming angry. If you become angry yourself, all you are doing is compounding the hurt that the other person already has made. In fact, if you don't react at all, if you have metta, there is no hurt there. Right? The other person says so. You shrug your shoulders, no hurt. That's the best thing, right? So no hurt. And by reacting in this way, you're also allowing the other person to reflect on their own actions. It's very powerful. If somebody does something to you, they say something bad, and you react badly in return, very often that's what they want from you, right? They want a reaction out of you. But if you don't react, it kind of stops them and says, what's going on here? I'm not able to kind of push their buttons or whatever. And when that happens, it's almost like you become a mirror to their own bad speech, right? Because they start reflecting on it. This is what we mean by somebody being a mirror to you. Because you reflect inwards rather than being satisfied that you've been able to push somebody's buttons. So often to remain calm and to remain compassionate, to remain considerate, even in difficult situations, can be very powerful, not just for yourself, but also for the other person. So interesting then that you have a mind of loving kindness, and you start you start with that person, right? This is the first person you start with, and then from him, from that person, you then pervade the all-encompassing world with metta, with loving kindness. So why is it that we start with that person? And usually we are told that in Buddhist metta you start with somebody who is friendly, right? You don't start with the most difficult one. So why is that? Well, first of all, this is already somebody who is pretty good at practicing metta, right? It's not the beginner, it's somebody who is already pretty high up there. They probably have good samadhi and all these kind of qualities. And if you're already doing very well in your practice, if you have one person who is difficult, one person who you might feel a bit upset about perhaps, or ideally not at all, then that is where the block is going to be to allow you to spread metta universally everywhere, right? So because that is the block, you start with that block, and once you unblock that person, then it is possible to practice metta in this way. Don't try this if you are just beginning on the path, because if you are, you're going to get very frustrated and you're going to have all kinds of negative thoughts coming instead. But once you start to get the hang of it, you can do that. But what it also means is that also in your own life, if there are people in your own life that you find difficult, that you find hard to deal with, you know, people at work or perhaps even family members or whatever, that you, or you know, when you meet them you feel really, it's really hard for you, and that is often where we should start, right? And that's where we should actually do something about that. Because if there is something in the back of our mind which feels uncomfortable about somebody, it's going to be also a hindrance to our ability to have metta, to develop our metta. So it's good to unblock those things and to try to change your perception of those people in your life who you find difficult. Try to understand them in a different way, right? What if they are so difficult? What is their life like? Probably they have a lot of suffering in their life, right? Do they really want to be difficult? How come they're so difficult? It must be something in the past. That's the only reason you can explain this. Right? And then you can have compassion, you can forgive, and you can let go. You can use these powerful tools to unblock that problem. And then, when you unblock the problem, then you can pervade the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving-kindness, abundance, right, full of loving-kindness, exalted, mahagata, gone to greatness, immeasurable, appamana, without limit, right? It's an unlimited mind. The idea is that it's not, I have meant that towards these people, but not to these ones because I don't like them. No, it's unlimited. There's no boundaries anymore in your metta. It just goes out and everybody is included there. Without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train them. Okay, so that is the basic paragraph in this sutta. And next we have the similes on what happens when you have developed loving kindness to the max. This is what happens. Because suppose a man came with a hoe and a basket and said, I shall make this great earth to be without earth. He would dig here and there, strew the soil here and there, spit here and there, and urinate here and there, saying, be without earth, be without earth. What do you think, Vickers? Could that man make this great earth to be without earth? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because this great earth is deep and immeasurable. It is not easy to make it be without earth. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Right? So this is what happens when you develop a mind of loving kindness to the maximum state. This is what you become. You become like the great earth. If somebody comes along and says, oh, I'm gonna bother this person, right? I'm gonna kind of give them a hard time or whatever, good luck. You're not gonna succeed. No, there's no way you can't do that. And I like this, I like the way it is said here, right? You dig a little bit here, dig a little bit there, you urinate a little bit here and there, right? It's like somebody is urinating on you, somebody who's kind of nasty. What they're doing is really they are kind of giving you all this negative stuff. Same kind of idea. But it doesn't touch you because your mind is so exhausted, even though they kind of affect a little bit of a corner of your mind is so vast that it cannot really affect you just in the same way as the great earth. So you become like untouchable. And when you are untouchable, eventually the man only reaps weariness and disappointment. Right? You can't pull, you can't push the buttons of this person anymore. His buttons have been removed. There are no buttons to push. And eventually you just give up. You don't try anymore to push the buttons of somebody who is so pure and has this kind of mind. And that's one of those great things that I see people who are very developed in the meditation practice. That you see precisely that. You cannot really pull any strings anymore. There's nothing there. There's no attachment. There's no craving. There's no holding on. If you try to manipulate somebody who has a very developed mind, after a while you realize you can't manipulate this person. And it's very strange because in our lives we tend to manipulate each other to a certain degree, right? Within family relationships, we may say something, or within work or with friends or whatever, we say something, the other person reacts in a certain way, all this kind of stuff. But there's always a little bit of manipulation going on. Often it's self-conscious, but it happens anyway. But sometimes you meet people and you can't manipulate them, right? Whatever you say doesn't really have any impact on the person. And it's very strange because it's not an ordinary kind of relationship anymore. It is a different type of relationship, and you have to give up the manipulation, and the relationship becomes much more pure and much more, it's a much better type of relationship. Ajahn Brahm is like that. You try to manipulate Ajahn Brahm, it can't be done. You can't manipulate him. It's just impossible. In fact, he will tend to do exactly the opposite of what you want him to do, right? So no manipulation will work. And there's something very good about that, very powerful about that, because it kind of throws you back. It makes you look at yourself. What am I doing here? You know, what is actually going on here? Am I really coming from the right place? If I get frustrated because I can't get Ajahn Brahm to do something, whose problem is it? Is it mine or Ajahn Brahm? It's my problem, right? I'm the one who wants him to do a certain thing. Forget it. You're not going to get Ajahn Brahm to do anything. Trying to give him healthy food? Absolutely no way. He eats what he eats, right? Fish and chips and that sort of stuff? Okay, that's what he eats. You cannot get Ajahn Brahm to do anything. He's very, very, very independent in that way. And it's great, because it shows you that the problem is mine. I'm the one who has the attachment, right? I have to let go. And you actually learn from that if you do it in the right way. Otherwise, you get weariness and disappointment, as I said. Okay, so let us move on to the next simile. I'll just skip the little paragraph because it's just a repeat of what was before. Because suppose a man came with crimson, turmeric, indigo, or carmine and said, I shall draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space. What do you think, Vickers? Could that man draw pictures and make pictures appear on empty space? No, beautiful sir. Why is that? Because empty space is formless and it doesn't manifest. It is not easy to draw pictures there and make pictures appear there. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Right? I like that. Understatement, it is not easy to draw pictures there. it's actually quite Buddhist. The original understater, not the British, it was the Buddha was the original understater. It's always very understated in his the way he speaks. So here somebody comes along, right? All of these things, you see crimson, turmeric, these are all different kind of colors, right? So, and he's going to draw a picture of empty space. Now, this is a bit like if you come to somebody, if there is a person who has again practiced a long way on the path, if you have attained these immeasurable states, there is very little sense of self left inside of you. There's almost no self there. Now, the only way you can manipulate somebody, you can get the reaction out of somebody, is if there is a sense of self there. Because you say something, they will defend themselves. No, that is not right. You are attacking me, right? Etc., etc. It's a sense of self which makes it possible to get a reaction out of somebody. But if there is no self there, there is nothing to kind of to attack anymore, right? There's nobody who's going to be offended. Nobody's going to say anything because there's nothing inside of them which can take that, which actually that applies to that criticism or whatever it is that the other person has. So this is like empty space. You are empty inside. Sunyata. Sunyata is one of those words that in Pali is equivalent or roughly equivalent to non-self. Anatta and sunyata have the same kind of meaning. So if you are sunyata inside and somebody says, I hate you, you're a bad person, you've done all these bad things, there's nothing inside of you to which that can attach. So you just shrug your shoulders, okay? Whatever, I don't know what you mean, but say what you must or whatever. And so there's nothing there which really can be affected by that kind of criticism. So you're empty inside, just like empty space is empty. And eventually the man reaps only weariness and disappointment yet again. Then we have the next simile, Bhikkhu. Suppose a man came with a blazing grass torch and said, I shall heat up and burn away the river Ganges with this blazing grass torch. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man heat up and burn away the river Ganges with that blazing grass torch? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because the river Ganges is deep and immense. It is not easy to heat it up or burn it away with a blazing grass torch. Eventually, the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. So, the river Ganges, many people have been to the river Ganges? Yes? Okay. It's really, really big, right? It's one of the big, really big rivers in the world. If you go to Patna today, you can see there's a bridge over the river Patna. It's like you're on this bridge for 3 or 4 kilometers, right, before you reach the other side. It's just enormous, this river Ganges. Absolutely massive. And of course, again, this is the idea of the mind that is very developed. And you have the grass torch, like the remember heat, and it's always a synonym for anger, right? Or for any kind of defilement, really. So somebody coming along with a grass torch, or somebody who is angry and upset, right? And they're going to tell you off or whatever. They're going to be nasty to you. They're going to speak to you in a bad way that you don't like. So then they want to transfer some of that heat to you. But you happen to be the living angels, right? So they're going to have a very hard time transferring that heat to you. What is so funny about these similes is that they're kind of so outrageous, right? Imagine this man coming with a blazing grass torch. Ha! I shall heat and burn away the river Ganges. It's like some kind of a comedy show or something. So it can't be done, right? There isn't enough heat in that blazing grass torch. The river Ganges just continues on its way, completely ignoring what is going on. No heat is really transferred to that river because it's just too large. Okay, I'll do one more of these similes, and then I'll leave the last one to afterwards, perhaps. Because suppose there were a catskin bag that was rubbed, well rubbed, thoroughly well rubbed, soft, silky, rib of rustling, rib of crackling, and a man came with a stick or a potsherd and said, there is this catskin bag that is rubbed, etc., rib of rustling, rid of crackling. I shall make it rustle and crackle. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Could that man make it rustle or crackle with a stick or the potsherd? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that catskin bag being rubbed, rid of rustling, rid of crackling, is not easy to make it rustle or crackle with the stick or the potsherd. Eventually the man would reap only weariness and disappointment. Right, so here is something that you have completely given up all defilements, no defilements left. I think the rustling and the crackling here are similes for the defilements. And when they have been completely abandoned, there's no underlying tendency, nothing left there. If somebody comes along and says, I'm going to make them reappear again, it's impossible because they have been completely abandoned, they are gone. In just the same way that the catskin bag is completely rid of crackling and rustling. It's a strange simile because we don't have, I have never heard of catskin bags before I'm reading the sutta, so you don't really understand exactly what's going on. But you get the rough idea. So there's nothing you can do about that. Let's do the last simile as well, because the last one is the most powerful one of all them. So, because even if bandits were to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handed sword, he who gave rise to a mind of hate towards them would not be carrying out my teaching. Hearing bhikkhus, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected. We shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassionate for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness and starting with them, right? The bandits who are hacking your heart. Starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how we should train bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen. Because if you keep this advice on the simile of soul constantly in mind, do you see any way of speech, trivial or gross, that you could not endure? No, venerable sir. Therefore, because we should keep this advice on the simile of soul constantly in mind, that will lead to welfare and happiness for a long time. This is a very powerful, very famous simile of the Buddha, right? The simile of the two-handed sword. And sometimes you read it and you think, what? That's asking too much, right? There's no way I can't do that. This is really asking too much. And I used to read it, I used to think pretty much like that. I just thought, wow, you know, is it serious or what? But of course, the Buddha is serious, right? The Buddha doesn't mince his word. He doesn't mess around. If that's what he says, that is what he says. So how is it possible? Imagine, I don't know if you have seen these two-handed swords. These men have chainsaws. They always had this long two-handed swords, one man in one and one the other one, and they kind of put it on you and they start cutting off your legs and arms, right? Now, how easy is it to have loving kindness for those people? Really difficult, right? How can we do that? How is it possible, man? And the only way you can do that is the things that we're talking about for now. Remember that these people have no idea what they're doing. They are just being absolutely stupid. They are doing this because of some demons or some crazy things inside their own mind. Because they're deluded, because they're stupid, because they don't understand that they're creating enormous amounts of suffering for themselves. So what you're doing, you are changing your perspective. Instead of focusing on yourself and thinking about your own hurt and thinking about your own problems, you're letting go of yourself and you're focusing on the other person instead. And when you focus on the other person without being self-centered, then you can have compassion for them because you understand that they are driven by blindness, by darkness in their minds. That is what is driving people to do this kind of crazy things. And then you're able to endure the pain. Okay, you lose your leg, okay, and then maybe afterwards you die, right? But if you have so much good karma, dying is no big deal. If you have that kind of karma, whereby you have loving kindness for the whole world, abundant, without any distinction anywhere, you're going to get reborn in a very, very nice place, right? Good riddance for the body, right? Happy, okay. Let's move on into more happiness in the future. No worries at the same Australia. Easy. So you actually, for you, it's not a big deal. And this is one of those strange things in Buddhism. Death is not such a big issue. What is the issue is how you live your life. If you live your life well, you know that you're going to go to a good place in the future. So death is just like a transition. Transitions are no big deal. It is how we live our lives. That is what matters. You live your life the right way, then death is no problem. So remember this, that when people, one of the important ways also of understanding this is when people do bad things towards you, it is not personal. It is not about you, right? If those bandits with a two-handed sword, if they had seen another person who was there, who was roughly like you, they would have chopped off their limbs instead, right? It's got nothing to do with you. Very often, the reason why we get upset when other people treat us in a bad way is because we feel it's personal. They're doing it towards me, right? I don't want this. It's towards me. No, it isn't towards you. they are doing it because of conditions inside of themselves. It's got nothing to do with you. It is never personal. When people say something bad towards you, something unpleasant, it is never personal. It is not about you and them. It's only about them, their own internal state of mind. That is what it's about. If you take away the feeling that it is personal, then you are taking away a lot of the basis for anger to arise in you. If you don't feel it's personal anymore, there is much, much less chance that anger will arise in you. This is one of those skillful ways of reducing anger in your life. Remember, it's never personal. The person is reacting because of their own cause and conditions, but nothing to do with you. Put another person in your place, which is roughly like you, exactly the same thing would happen. Okay, so, yes, please. Okay, quickly. Sure, yeah.
With regards to people hurting you,
yeah.
Isn't there room where if they're going to hurt you physically,
yeah.
You should at least try to defend yourself? Or if they're going to hurt your loved one, do we just act so passively and just let them wipe the heck out of us and just have lots of backup?
No, that would be the wrong way of looking at it. This is not about being passive. This is about your mental state, right? This is about the idea. Remember, this is the ideal, right? You're not going to be able to live up to this straight away anyway. It's going to take a lot of time. Maybe 20 years' time, maybe, right? Maybe next life. It's hard to know. But all this is very hard to do anyway. So don't try to understand that state of mind, because you cannot really fully understand it until you get there. Once you get there, then you will understand, and actually, then you'll probably see, wow, this really is very beautiful after all. In the meantime, yes, you have to defend yourself, it's true, but you try to defend yourself, also understanding the other person, right? Understanding both sides of the equation, so you don't get too angry. When you get angry, you tend to make mistakes, you do all kinds of things. So you defend yourself, but with a certain amount of equanimity, with a certain amount of trying to reduce the harm for everybody involved. This is what it is really about. So yes, your emphasis should first of all be on yourself, on your family members, whoever it is who are harmed, and you should do whatever it takes to get out of that. But you try to avoid violence, right? If you use violence to stop violence, usually it just escalates and gets worse. You try to avoid violence. Try to find other ways of getting out of a difficult situation. If you are smart, it's usually other ways of dealing with it that you can withdraw and get out of that problem. Very often there is. But of course, sometimes it's necessary, right? If somebody is very difficult, sometimes you have to go to the police, right? And say, it's too hard. And that's okay. Sometimes it is maybe better off being in prison, this person, if they really are bad. Sometimes you have to do that. And this does not mean you should not look after yourself at all. It just means that you are trying to have the right attitude in the whole situation. Yes? Okay. Yes?
I just wanted to make a comment.
Yeah, please.
I got a friend who says that, you know, he got an uncle who was so mad when somebody blocked his car.
Yeah.
And so he started banging on the car, you know.
Yeah.
And he woke himself so badly up, you know.
Yeah.
That when he went back to his car with his wife, and along the way he suffered a heart attack and passed away.
Sometimes
when you overreact on this,
yeah.
You harm yourself.
Oh, indeed, yeah. Exactly, and anger is one of the worst things. If you have high blood pressure or something already, you get angry, it increases a lot, right? Makes it much worse. Yes, anger is very unhealthy, right? Very unhealthy. So it's actually good for your health. The more mental you have, the better it is for your health. As I'm wrong, he says, one of the reasons that you can eat so much bad food, apparently it has been shown that if you laugh a lot, right? If you laugh a lot, it expands the veins, the blood, the blockage in the body. So he says, well, I can eat all this bad stuff in my veins, that's so big. Right? But I laugh so much all the time, so no problem. And I think it's true. I don't think it's about laughing, but it's about having metta and kindness. It actually makes you very healthy as a person. And if you get away with things that other people maybe can't get away with. So, yes, that's a very good point. Thank you for that. Anyway, so now let us take a break and let us see you back here again at 3:20. Okay.